I think we got, oh, there we go. There's audio. So we got 5 o'clock. Let's get this party started here. Or let's finish this party. What's that? It's 5 o'clock here. And we got Ask the Experts and beverages coming after. So I will do my best to keep you guys well entertained. I know it's the end of a long day. We used to have our internal conferences down here in this convention center. I think we got a 2-year deal on it. We had back-to-back years here. And I hadn't been here for a while, and I forgot that the conference center is linear. And I remember being exhausted after a week here of just walking back and forth. And I don't know about you guys, but there's a hotel up at the top, like a big Hilton or a Marriott or something. I was staying there. So between that and just roaming the halls, hope you brought some tennis shoes. I know I just kept going and going and going to find the session. So thank you for finding the session. I guess if you're here for Link, you can just stay in this room for the whole week because it seems like all of our sessions are here. So just kind of drink Diet Coke and use that bathroom out there and you can camp out. So my name's Andrew Schneiderman. I work in the Link product group, and my job largely is to talk to customers and understand how you guys use our products and how we can do a better job and how we can get you guys to adopt them easier and use them more broadly. So thrilled to be here because I get to talk to a bunch of customers that are interested in doing work with our stuff. Conferencing in particular is an interest of mine. Conferencing really brings it all together and lights up kind of the really rich collaboration scenarios that we do with Link. So I wrote this deck initially for our Link conference that we had in February. That's why we had the surfing music, because our Link conference was in San Diego, so that was the best I could come up with for San Diego, and I wasn't clever enough to come up with jazz or something for New Orleans. At the Link conference, we actually had 2 sessions on conferencing. One was on deploying conferencing, and the other was on planning conferencing. So what I've done is combine the two together, twice the content, half the time for this session. So we'll actually cover quite a bit. My email address is up there. I'll hang out after, and I'll go down to Ask the Experts. So if there's any stuff I didn't hit or you want to ask questions, feel free to track me down. So usually this slide comes at the end, but I thought I'd start by reflecting on if you're focused on getting conferencing done for your company, in addition to this session, these guys round it all out. There's just no way I can cover everything, but we've had some great sessions yesterday, today, and a couple more tomorrow. That go into the next level of detail on stuff. I'll touch on almost all these areas. Actually, I took my migration slides out and I gave them to Dustin. So I don't have anything on migration here. So if you want migration, check Dustin's session out, which I think was yesterday. Network was a session earlier today. Always a good thing to do. Network planning, HADR monitoring, I think were yesterday. And then tomorrow there's a deep dive session on Edge. I encourage you to go to that. I'll just talk generally about why you want Edge. And then Link Room System, which is really cool, is Friday. I think it's the very last session Friday. But you can also come by the exhibition hall, and Crestron, our partner's got a Link Room System set up so you can actually touch it and see how that thing works, and it's pretty cool. So I encourage you to do that. So that's all the stuff that's complementary to this. Here's what I'm going to cover. First, we're going to do a demo because it's late in the day, and you're probably sick of looking at slides. So it'll wake me up, wake you up, we'll actually do some stuff on the keyboard. We'll just deploy conferencing, and we'll be done. We won't be done. But we'll start with that. Then we'll pop back up, and we'll look at it from a client perspective. And then we'll kind of look at the guts, look under the hood at the different components that actually power conferencing. So I want to give you guys an idea of how this stuff works in addition to how to plan for it and how to configure and deploy it. So this deck has kind of 3 different types of content in it. Some of it is really practical, how to deploy. Some of it is a little bit conceptual on how it works. I feel like you need to understand a little bit how it works because it really helps you design and deploy. So I'll spend a little time on that. And then there's planning. And you got to plan. One of my favorite sayings is fail to plan to fail. Tell that to my kids, they don't listen. But fundamentally, I could spend this whole time talking about planning, but it's a pretty dry topic. But don't leave this room with the illusion that you can just go next, finish. There's a little bit of due diligence to do to make sure you get it right. So I'll hit planning at the end. We'll hit scheduling. I'll pop back out, show you some client-side stuff on how scheduling and joining looks like from a client perspective. And then we'll spend a bit of time focusing on dial-in, getting dial-in conferencing right, because it's a big part of enabling conferencing, and it's potentially the most complicated bit. So with that, let's see if I can manage to switch. Oops, I guess I can't. There we go. Those buttons are tough. All right, so when I was first doing this session, I was talking to one of the PMs, and at that point, it was called Deploying Link. And the guy said, well, you got to talk about all the improvements we made in deploying. So I'm going to do that real quick. Who has OCS in their environment today? Maybe a third. Who has Link? Link 2010. More than a third. Anybody have Link 2013? Well, what are you doing here? You're done. All right, well, for those that go back to the OCS days, setup was pretty rudimentary, and we did have this deployment wizard, which I've put up here on the screen. We can zoom into it a little bit. This guy was pretty important to us. This guy you ran on every server role. It had a bunch of wizards to tell you how to deploy a front end or a back end or a mediation server, et cetera. In 2010, we did a whole bunch of investment to make deploying the product easier for you and also to have a way to enforce a standard configuration. So we effectively schematized the entire setup process. We created a database that we call the CMS, Central Management Store, and we store in kind of a XML format all the configuration items in your environment in that database. So this piece here, which is the deployment wizard, became much less important. That said, there's some stuff you need to do in here. So for the very first thing you need to do, you need to go in here and you need to run some steps to prepare your environment. So this prepare AD bit has three flavors. First, you have to extend your schema. So we need a bunch of different classes and objects to hold the information both on user objects as well as server objects for Link. We need to extend your forest, which is primarily a permissioning exercise and creation of some groups, and we need to extend your domain. So these three explicit steps need to be run on your environment to kind of make your Active Directory ready for Link. This guy here is run after you do your initial run through Topology Builder. So you build your topology, and we're going to go through that. It stores it all in CMS, and then afterwards you run this bit, or you can run a bootstrap or executable, or there's a PowerShell commandlet, enable CS computer, that will then look at that updated topology and update your servers correspondingly. So gone are the days of having to run this stuff on every single server. Let me point out one other thing on this guy. So if you're doing a small implementation or a lab implementation, you do need to do this step first before you even run Topology Builder. So this creates the first instance of that SQL database to store the CMS information, to store that topology. If you're deploying on Enterprise Edition, you're going to create a SQL server within Topology Builder, and that'll be the place where you put your first topology. But if you're doing it on Standard Edition, you got to hit this guy and do this step. And then, of course, the one thing I've done, this is just my PC, just my laptop, so I can't do any of this other stuff on it, is I've installed the admin tools. So the first thing we've got with the admin tools is we've got Topology Builder. So here's Topology Builder. Topology Builder just works off an XML file. Alternately, what you'll probably most typically do is you'll come in here and you'll choose this first option. It just says pull the existing topology from my current deployment. So it'll query CMS, it'll pull that information in, let you tweak it, let you make changes. You can also do this all offline. If you'd like to go home or sit in Starbucks and build your topology, you can do this completely offline, get back and publish it on your enterprise. In this case, we're just going to start from a blank slate here and create a brand new topology. Put an XML file to stick it in. SIP domains. So we'll be real. Oops. No keyboard. Is there a? Well, that's gonna mess with our demo a little bit. Let's see, is there anything else I can... Uh...
Oh, it's just Apology Builder. Here, let's do this. Let's get out of... this guy. Let's get out of this guy. And we'll try this one more time. Yay. Maybe.
Gotta love being up here with these ridiculously bright lights in your face and trying to do something simple like typing or press the right button. Anyway, I think we're good. Back to Topology Builder. So you got to define effectively an identity for your organization. You want to make that as simple as possible. SMTP domains is what we used as an identity in the email world. Everything within Link uses the SIP protocol, so we have SIP domains in this case, SIP addressing. So I'm going to create two. I did... tech at NA, I'll do tech at EMEA. Ideally, you limit this to one or two. You'll find your life as an admin managing and deploying Link gets incrementally harder with every additional SIP domain you create, because you need additional certificates, you need SAN entries on the certificates, you need additional DNS entries, all the authentication is done through discovering these various SIP domains. So keep it simple. Hopefully you only have one. In this case, I'm doing two just for example's sake. But you don't want to have a whole bunch of SIP domains. So let's make a site. I'll call this US South. A site is just a well-connected group of Link servers from a network perspective. We're in beautiful New Orleans. Let's see if I can spell Louisiana. Louisiana. I think that's right. So we've created a new site. Site's useless until we put some Link servers in there. The building block of Link is a pool. So let's get that first pool in there. The pool handles all the capabilities that we're going to talk about. So typically, we're going to do an EE pool, Enterprise Edition front-end pool. That gives you the scalability. You just add more front ends. It gives you a back end. So you can scale up higher, and you can have that backend failover. These pools can scale up to 80,000 concurrent users. Keep this simple here. I'm just going to do a standard edition server, which is an all-in-one standalone box. Can also be well used in multiple deployments. I think we scale it to a couple thousand users as opposed to much larger scale on Enterprise Edition. In this case, we'll just do SC1, tech at NA. So here's our first SE box. Now, what do I want to do on that guy? We'll go through what ticking these various boxes does, but of course I want everything, right? I certainly want conferencing. Those are all the MCUs or the conferencing services that service all these conferences. I certainly want dial-in capabilities. I want to reinforce to you guys that you've got to do dial-in conferencing. You can't really deploy conferencing and pretend that nobody's going to have a phone and want to dial in. So we're going to want to make sure we do dial-in and correspondingly enterprise voice. If you were here in the previous session for the smaller version of myself, Jeff went through a whole bunch of voice-specific capabilities you need, like E911 and response groups. Ticking this box will install all those as well. In this case, for conferencing, we just want the basic capability to route and to receive a call. Call admission control, one pool within every site needs to have that call admission control role. So when I place a call, it checks policy to make sure I have enough bandwidth on the designated link to place that call. So we'll enable CAC, we'll enable archiving. This last one, we really shouldn't even have a tick box here. This really should be mandatory. The monitoring server and the QoE database and the CDR database are really crucial for you guys to look as you deploy Link to see how people are adopting it. And for troubleshooting, it's how we plumb into System Center. Critical bit, so we're going to make sure we do monitoring. Mediation server. In this case, I'm just going to co-locate. If you're not doing media bypass, which means that mediation server is working hard because it's transcoding every call to G711, you'll want standalone mediation servers. In this case, again, for simplicity, we'll just co-locate it. I'm not going to tick this edge box. Instead, I'm going to tell you guys to take an hour out of your day and go to the edge session tomorrow. Because you tick that edge box, and all of a sudden, I got to define internal interfaces and external interfaces and all kinds of goodness that I don't have enough time to go into today. But you want to have edge in your deployment. In this case, if I did an enterprise edition pool, I'd have to define SQL, and I'd have to define how I want to give high availability to SQL. In this case, in Link 2013, we use SQL mirroring. We don't use SQL clustering. So here I have some options to enable SQL mirroring and to designate a witness so that if one of those nodes goes down, that witness will facilitate an automatic failover. I need a file share. So you need to have a share defined before you publish the topology. In this case, I'll call it link share. Every time I create a meeting and upload a PowerPoint or a whiteboard or a poll, it's going to use that share to store that information. So we'll define that share. Web services. More and more in the product, particularly in 2013, uses a web interface. We'll talk about simple URLs when you click in a meeting to join it. This is using the web interface. We have a whole bunch of different web services that are used for different things. So we need to specify both an internal and external web services URL to reach those services. WAC. So Office Web App Server, this is brand new in 2013. So we've gotten out of the business of doing PowerPoint rendering. Instead, we're using the Office streaming technology with that O365 uses to anytime you hit a PowerPoint, it automatically renders for you through HTTP. So in this case, we're going to have to create a new WAC server. By the way, it's called Office Web App Server. I just can't quite get myself to say that. WAC was kind of the nickname we gave it. Web Applications Companion, I think, was the initial naming. So it turned into WAC. So, whoops. TechEd. All right, so there's our WAC server. Oh, by the way, whoops, crap. Note this little tick box here. So WAC is meant to be a shared role. And in certain scenarios, you'll want those WAC servers in your perimeter. And I'll go through this in detail on how we actually use WAC, but effectively it's a collection of URLs that we provision to each client so they can get that PowerPoint streamed to them. If you do have your WAC servers in a different internet zone, effectively in the perimeter network, then you want to tick this box, and then we'll create those URLs correspondingly. So there we've got WAC. What do we got left? Ah, you can't use the same SQL store for your pool for monitoring and archiving. So I need to create a new SQL instance. So we'll create SQL01. And we'll just keep the default instance and ports. And we'll use that guy for archiving and for monitoring. So we just got a place for MySQL databases for the archiving service and the monitoring service. All right, so here's our new site. Let's pop it all open. So what is new and different? So the first thing you see in 2010, we have no more AV conferencing pools, we have no more monitoring servers, and we have no more archiving servers. And I can't draw a straight line, but you get the idea. So we did a bunch of work in 2013 to consolidate roles, to minimize the number of servers you guys have to manage. So the AV MCU used to be, you could enable that as a standalone role. Not anymore. It's co-located with the pool. Same with archiving, same with monitoring. We're out of the business using MSMQ and having dedicated servers there. Every single front-end server has those capabilities. So you don't see those as standalone servers. One thing you see that's new in 2013, and we won't talk about it here, but we have made pChat, used to be called GroupChat, a full class member from an admin and management perspective. Shows up in Topology Builder. It also shows up in the web control panel. And one other thing that we can point out here is we've got these guys. So these WAC servers now will show up as shared resources. So I'm done. I've created a topology. At this point, I would publish it. I can't publish here because I've got nowhere to go. But assuming I was online, I'd publish. It would push this all out to CMS. And I can just run setup on each of my link servers, and it'll pull that topology in. And I'm done. So I think 20 minutes in, we've deployed conferencing. So you guys want to go to Ask the Experts and have some beverages, or? I kind of do. No, I'm kidding. We'll carry on. I think that's all I wanted to show you guys here. So we'll pop back to, oh, crap. There we go. All right, so back to slides. So let's look at this a little bit from a client perspective. Let's pop up a little bit. So this slide's kind of fun to do. This is all the cool stuff we can do in a conference, and this has increased in every release. So we started with the basics, IAM, application sharing, and really early versions of the product. We've added rich audio, rich video capabilities. Video's a big bit in this release. PowerPoint, whiteboard, polls, those are all squarely conferencing features for kind of structured collab sessions, recording. And then new in this release is note-taking. So we finally had the aha moment that what do you do most often in a conference? Well, you take notes. So now you can just click a little widget to share a shared OneNote. Everybody in the meeting gets a URL to that shared OneNote. Everybody can collaborate in it. It populates the roster automatically. If you put a picture in the OneNote or share a PowerPoint in the session, all that gets dumped in the OneNote. So nifty bit there. So on the left-hand side of this guy are the traditional rich clients that we all kind of know and love, the full link client. Link Web App got a total makeover this release, so we now do native audio video within Link Web App. Don't need Link Attendee anymore. Used to be our solution for native audio video in the 2010 space. We also shipped a VDI client with this release, so if you need to localize media on a thin client, you can use that guy. And then there's a slick Slate or Windows 8 modern client that you can use on your RT that I'm sure you guys have all purchased, or your Surface Pro. Then on the bottom, we've got a whole bunch of kind of specialized clients. Of course, we got our Link Phone that we make and partners make. We've got a web scheduler that's a standalone bit that now ships with the product. It used to be ResKit, now it's with the product. And we also have the capability in the latest release of Exchange with OWA that you can actually schedule a Link meeting from within OWA. So any browser you can get to on any machine, you can schedule a Link meeting now. Of course, we have our Outlook add-in, we have the Link Recording Manager, and then on the right, we've got some brand new clients. So the mobile clients, we shipped a whole slew of new mobile clients in CU1. So there's actually four. There's two for the iOS, there's the iPad and the iPhone client, there's an Android client, and a Windows Phone client. The Link Meeting Room, come by and check that out. And of course, we still support phones. So if you got a phone, you got your old Motorola StarTech, and you want to dial into a Link meeting, absolutely you can do that as well.
I have a question about the OWA scheduler.
Does that
require Exchange 2013?
Yes. Correct. Link Web App. Pretty big deal for us. We wanted to be able to build a solution that anybody could join with or without a Link client. We wanted it to run across a whole slew of different flavors of browsers. We wanted to get off of the dependency that we had on Silverlight for the prior one. We wanted to support anonymous users as well as authenticated users. We wanted it to be able to be used not only by an attendee, but also by a presenter. You can do the plugin. So there's a plugin. We wrote a plugin for every one of these browser platforms that we support. If you want to join media through a phone or another way, you can join without the plugin, like if you're on a Linux workstation, for example. So one bit here, and so what I'll try and do as I go through these slides is I'll surface the PowerShell commandlets that you can use. You can go back and use this as a reference point if some of these capabilities are stuff that you want to enable. 9 times out of 10, you'll find the same configuration options in the Link Control Panel or our web interface. But a lot of times we surface stuff in PowerShell that you can't do there. So I'll show the PowerShell commandlets in there. So that's that show join using legacy client. So if you do have a scenario where because of a certain version of OS you're using, or maybe you still have the R2 client out there, and you want folks to have the option to join another way besides LWA, you can use that guy. And one other trick here, this question mark SL equal, is a bit to fool Link into forcing that Link web app to load regardless of what's running on the machine. So if you're running Link on the machine, Link web app will never start because we always prefer the rich experience. But if you want to see that LWA is working, or you want to join as a different type of user, or you're troubleshooting, whatever the case, just stick a question mark SL equals on the end of that URL, and it'll force the web app to join. All right. So to change gears a little bit, let's look at how this guy works. You know, what are the individual components that power conferencing and Link? So I'm going to start with IAM, and you might say, why IAM? IAM is not even a conference, a conferencing workload. This is actually our first MCU, the IAM MCU, and it's actually an interesting one. IAM uses SIP as our transport, and everything goes to the server. So if I do a peer-to-peer call, it'll bypass all server components, even a video call. But IAM will always route through the server. Well, why do we do that? Archiving is one reason. A lot of companies have a requirement to archive electronic communication, so we need that IAM to go through the server in order to intercept it and put it in an archive. It also gives us the capability to give you some neat tools for filtering. We have a couple filters that we've built that run on each front-end server. There's the URL filter that will block malicious URLs. If you don't want users clicking on stuff that comes in through IAM, you can turn that guy on, and the file filter as well. If you don't want your users sending around EXEs, for example, you can block those. So the control panel, the web interface, you'll find those in the IAM presence tab. In PowerShell, it's CS file transfer filter and CS IAM filter. You can manage those. All this stuff goes over SIP. IAM is pretty lightweight, so we just put the payload directly within the SIP protocol. So you won't be able to see it because it's encrypted, but it's just all going over the same protocol that we use for call setup and all the signaling mechanisms. And the last bit here is sometimes customers have a need to prevent different user populations within their company from talking to each other. So there are third-party products that do ethical walls to prevent that. We have some code samples do it, but we don't do that natively in the product. So that's IAM. That's our IAM MCU. Application sharing. So here we start to get a little more complicated. In this case, I've got three people participating with our application sharing MCU. The double-headed arrow guy is the guy that's actually doing the sharing. We do application sharing a little differently than other solutions in this space. We don't do it as a video stream. So I think H329, 239, and BFCP are ways other folks do it to actually render a video stream to show the share. In our case, we're using RDP, which is the same protocol we use for terminal services, any kind of remoting. So that gives us some really neat capabilities. You can share your desktop. You can share an app. You can actually allow somebody else to have control. They can take control of your machine. So it has a lot of richness, but it also has some security implications, particularly if you have a meeting you've got some external participants in. So correspondingly, in the CS conferencing policy, we've given you some capabilities to lock this down. So for example, if you have a conference where you have folks that are external and you don't want those folks being able to remote control somebody else's machine, you can disable that. RDP gives us all these this flexibility and these capabilities, but it also means it's really not suitable for certain things like CAD or rendering video images. You won't see good performance with application sharing in those scenarios. We do support sticking a video in a PowerPoint and streaming that through WAC, if that's a use case you're interested in. But if you're doing really detailed CAD, CAM, stuff like that, it's probably isn't the guy you want to do. We have done some optimizations in 2013 to improve the quality and reduce the bandwidth footprint this guy produces. You will see it's bursty, though. You will see when you first kick off an app sharing session, you'll see a spike in network traffic. And then from there on, it's driven by deltas, by how much the screen's changing. So typically, if you're collaborating on some static content, whether it's a PowerPoint or a Word document, this is very manageable. But if you're doing something that's got a lot of movement, you'll see a bit of network traffic. So we've got this app sharing bitrate KB, if that's a concern to you, and you can put a limit on that. The other thing we've added in 2013 is we added some instrumentation. So we'll actually put records in the QoE database specifically for app sharing sessions. So you can pull that data out, and you can start to see how that's working on your network. So that's app sharing. This guy, yeah.
So the only way that you support
That's the way we recommend. You can try doing it with this. There's nothing that will prevent you from doing it with app sharing. But if you want to stream a video out to a whole bunch of folks, that's going to be your best bet. Right, so the AV conferencing server. This guy's kind of the workhorse of the bunch. It does two separate things, AV, audio, video. So I've kind of made this target slide here where I've split the server in half, and I've got audio on the left, video on the right, and then correspondingly I've got send on the top and receive on the bottom. So let's take a look at what this guy does in both those scenarios. So from an audio perspective, not too tough. Everybody in the conference who isn't muted is going to send an audio stream to the AV conference, AV MCU. And we're going to look at those streams, and we're going to take the top five that are most active that we determine with an algorithm are the most active, and we're going to mix those together. And we're going to send a single mix stream out to everybody in the conference of those five. That's what we're doing on the audio side. On the video side, we do things a little bit differently. Video is a much heavier protocol. Much more expensive to do something like mixing. So we don't mix video, we switch video. And we've always switched video. In 2010, we switched video based on whoever was speaking. In 2013, we do that still, except we give you the capability to show up to five simultaneous HD streams. So in a video call, every single person in that call that somebody has subscribed to their video will be sending a video stream. So we allow you as the user in that meeting to say, I want to look at my boss, or I want to look at this guy because you know it's the person I'm talking to, the subject of the meeting, or I want to look at this guy because he's on board and he's doing funny things with his face. So you can pin all those different folks you want to see, and the AVMCU will then ask each of those recipients to send a stream. Correspondingly, at the same time, each receiver will tell the AVMCU what they're capable of receiving. So maybe I've gone full screen, that means I want a higher resolution image. Or maybe I'm on a phone, that means I can't take a higher resolution image or I'm bandwidth constrained. Or maybe I'm an older machine that doesn't have the processing power to decode an HD stream. So it takes all those considerations into account, ships that up to the AVMCU, and the AVMCU then begins to track. We call those video source requests. So the AVMCU is tracking what the receivers can receive, what videos I want to send, and then it does some really interesting things to optimize what it's then sending out to each receiver to show those five streams, and to show them at the right resolution. So to recap here, we mix audio, we switch video, we use a new codec called H.264. This is compliant with the industry standard AVC codec, and it also adds scalable video coding on top of it. That's what SVC stands for. Specifically, we do temporal scalability. I just like saying that. It makes me sound smart. But temporal scalability is really just changing a frame rate. So if I'm getting a 1080p 30 frames per second, which is the maximum quality we send, but a client doesn't have the network capacity to take that stream, I can selectively strip away frames so that I reduce the frame rate. So that enables me to get one stream from the sender and then take that same stream and send it out in a managed way to different devices. We still have the old codec RTVC1 in the product because if you have 2010 or R2 clients, that's what they're going to send. So you may well see scenarios where a client will send multiple streams. And those can be different resolution streams, or they can be an older RTVC1 stream and an H.264 stream. No more H.263. That was kind of the G711 of video for backwards compatibility. It was a really old video codec, kind of poor quality, not in the product anymore. And one last thing I'll talk about here, because I think it's just a cool bit, is we have something called smart cropping. So in the client, in a conference, we render the video. We send the full aspect ratio, you know, the rectangle. But typically in a conference, you just have the talking head, so we square that off using an algorithm we got from Microsoft Research for facial recognition. If two people pop into that video screen, we'll make it wide again so you can see both people. But that way we make the best use of the real estate in the client, and we can render that video gallery that hopefully you guys have seen in the client. So that's the AV conferencing server. A couple of deployment considerations for the AVMCU and for, well, I guess this is specifically for the AVMCU. Sorry. So So here's the mantra for the AVMCU: measure twice, cut once. So I know the tendency of us all is to think about the potential network tax video is going to have on my network. But what we found is content is king, and Link is really optimized around content sharing scenarios. So while you might have a burst at the beginning of the call where everybody's playing around with video, typically video becomes a second class citizen, a smaller, you know, once you have a small strip of video at the top and content in the middle, maybe even IM on the side, the resolution drops significantly, and the amount of bandwidth we need to maintain those images gets really low. So we've seen actually it's more like 500, 600 kilobits per second is the network bandwidth, even if you're doing multiple video streams. That said, of course, we give you dials and knobs that you as the administrator can manage these. So we can you can turn off multi-view, which is the five simultaneous video streams from an organizer or a attendee perspective, and you can use these video bitrate KB both on the send side and the receive side to put a cap on how much bandwidth video can take all up. And then we also, of course, have CAC. So if you have links that you're worried about oversubscribing, just put CAC on those links and we won't send video over your defined thresholds. I put this link here at the bottom. The video PM did a really great job defining some video scenarios and posting those up on TechNet on how to manage video quality on your network, different config scenarios and different bandwidth examples. WAC. Oh, so why did we do WAC? I think I mentioned it before. Our forte, our strength, is not rendering PowerPoints. And our PowerPoint rendering technology was kind of klutzy. It relied on some old Office DLLs, didn't do animation, stuff like that. The Office team was coming out with some really cool new technology to stream PowerPoints as part of our whole capability to have all of our all of Office web-enabled. So we just decided, let's use their technology to do that. We'll go through the security model a little bit. It can be shared. SharePoint uses it. OneNote uses it. Anytime you access any Office stuff on a website and you look at a web view of a PowerPoint file, it's the same technology. We're using the same thing. So WAC is indeed a shared set of servers. Multiple link pools can share the same set of WAC servers. You can have multiple WAC servers in different geographies for link pools to share. SharePoint can use the same WAC servers. Virtualizing it might be a good option. Lots of different ways to deploy WAC. But if you don't deploy WAC, you won't get, your 2013 clients won't get the PowerPoint rendering capabilities. So you need this guy in your topology. Yeah? Not if you're on 2013. If you're on 2010, yeah. So the data MCU that's in the middle of this slide is how we did this in 2010 and prior versions. And it's still in the middle of things. So we've got our data MCU. We've got the link share that we created as we went through in Topology Builder earlier. And then we've got our central management store. And in there, we store these URLs that we create that each client gets pushed to when they join a link meeting, like a viewer URL, a private viewing URL, attendee URL versus presenter URL, et cetera. When we tick that little box in Topology Builder, it figures out how to create those URLs and sticks them in CMS. So the blue box is all the link bits, and then we've got our WAC server sitting over here on the right. And then here's how this guy works. So presenter joins, he uploads a file. Effectively, that goes through the data MCU and stores it on our share. Begins to present that file, the attendee comes, and the attendee actually gets a URL with a token and an address for that file. So the attendee then goes back to the data MCU and says, get me that file. That file then is streamed, WAC gets the address of that file, so it can then stream that effectively out to all the participants. So at that point, I've got a connection to the WAC server, my 2013 attendee, and he's going to have a stream of that PowerPoint deck and all the changes that go through as I flip through it or go backwards, forwards. We actually have a capability in 2013 that you can do a private view. So if you've enabled that, folks can actually say, I want to be able to look ahead, I want to see the thumbnails, I want to do stuff without changing folks what other folks are doing in the meeting. In that case, they'll get their own private URL as we render those images to them. So all this is effectively done just by pushing a managed set of URLs out to each client that they consume. And then to your question, the 2010 attendee, he doesn't have anything to do with this. He doesn't understand WAC, and he's going to get the traditional PowerPoint experience from the data MCU. So the presenter will effectively upload at the beginning two versions of the file, one for the 2010 attendees that'll go through the data MCU and the content share, and then the 2013 guys will use the new service streaming from WAC. So we'll use that token to authenticate to get that file initially, and then that file is never left resident on any of the devices. So if you have a mobile device, this is all just streamed to the device. So from a security perspective, this is a nifty model as well. Does the presenter actually have to do it? The presenter has to say, I want to share a PowerPoint, here's the file. And then Link will take that file and store it on the content share. And everybody joining that meeting will then begin to get those broadcast URLs. So all the presenter has to do is say, I want to share this file. That is totally different. If he shares his desktop, it's back to the application sharing MCU, and it's using RDP. So if you can share your desktop, you can share PowerPoint, et cetera. PowerPoint's a very specific case for streaming. And this is back to somebody's question over there. If I want to do a video, stick a video in the PowerPoint, and then I'm going to stream that video experience to every endpoint from that central server. Yeah, so actually, here you can specify how long that content's maintained. By default, we keep it for 15 days, and then we'll clean it up after that meeting's over. Somebody else have a question? Yeah. Oh, sure, those guys can be external. And then, yeah, so as long as that WAC server is reachable by an external client, so if you had WAC deployed in your perimeter, and you have, you've published that those URLs so outside users can get to them, absolutely. No, it doesn't go edge at all. It's just a web service, so it's just, if you're publishing it through a reverse proxy, however you are publishing those URLs to get to that WAC server. Resiliency? Yeah, so WAC can be deployed as a pool. So in these examples, I just have a single WAC server, but there's no reason you can't deploy a pool of WAC servers, and then they'll fail over between them with a load balancer in front of them. So I'm going to keep marching on because I got a lot to cover, but if I miss a question, just come up and ask me after. Oops. So real quick, a couple of key points here. We talked about the topology builder. By default, WAC limits you to 15 meg of an upload. But if your video scenario is an important one to you, there's an XML file that you can edit on the WAC servers that allow you to increase that. Want to call that out. There's also a ResKit tool that if you're worried about maintaining this content or deleting it before, there's a ResKit tool. Or somebody leaves the company and you want to get rid of their content, there's a ResKit tool to allow you to do that. Quick hit on archiving. So archiving, we used to use MSMQ. We added this link storage service that's an abstraction layer that lets us archive directly into Exchange, also lets us keep archiving into SQL if you want to. The key bits here, so IAM is gonna go through lists, the data MCU is gonna go through lists, the archive share. So what's new is we weren't able to archive whiteboard and polling information. Now we do that as well. And we actually released a tool that if you wanna, reconstruct a whiteboard, because it's just stored as XML data in either Exchange or SQL, there's a tool that you can recreate that take that XML and render it as an HTML web page to see what was on that whiteboard. So I wanted to touch on HADR quickly. There's a whole session on it yesterday, but it gets a little bit hairy, and I wanted to look at it from the perspective just of conferencing. So the HA stuff in Link was a big investment area for us, and it's awesome stuff, but one of the things we gloss over is that one of the things it enables that we couldn't do before in 2010 is failover, full fidelity failover for conferences. So your buddy list and your conferences all get replicated between every front-end server and across to its paired pool. So if you lose a pool for whatever reason and you fail over, you still have all your conferences. So we care about the conferences, the conference directory, and meeting content. So how do we protect those? So we use Windows Fabric to do this failover, and you have to have three front-end servers to create a grouping for Windows Fabric, a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary. So you got to have at least three front-end servers in a pool. So Windows Fabric is managing replication within each of those servers, but then we also need to protect our RTC database. So RTC database is where we have our conferencing information, and that's where the conferencing directories are stored as well. Excuse me. So we want to make sure that information is in RTC is protected, and we do that by SQL mirroring. Right? So that's protected with a SQL mirror. And then finally, our meeting content, where uploaded PowerPoints, whiteboard, all that content is stored, is protected with DFS. So we got three different replication technologies going on over here on the left to make sure you have HA. Then into the green box, we have a pool, ideally in another data center, that we can pair with. And we have a backup service that routinely takes the information on those front ends, ships it over, kind of like a log shipping scenario, to another set, another pool with three front ends or more, that then pushes that data out to the RTC database and out to the content share. So I wanted one slide to show visually how these different topologies might look in your example. So you have, in this slide, I've got North America, I've got an EMEA, two data centers, two regions. I've got a pool, in this case, an enterprise pool, in my North America data center. It's got my grouping of servers plus my SQL mirror for HA. And then I have a set of shared services on the bottom that my whole infrastructure is going to use. So in addition to WAC, I have my monitoring and my archiving database, and I have different various content shares. What else do I need? I've got to have a connection to the PSTN so that I can make sure I can call out and join conference calls from any phone. And then I want to have connectivity to the internet for those scenarios where folks are going to be joining meetings from a Starbucks or home office or somebody outside my company, somebody I'm federated with or somebody who's just joining anonymously. Those edge servers enable that. Now then I can choose, if I have a large enough company and I have multiple data centers, to deploy additional pools depending on my requirements for scale and geographical coverage. In this case, I have another pool in EMEA. And here's where I can pair those pools if I want a disaster recovery scenario. And I threw in SE because there's no reason you can't use standard edition boxes if that meets your requirements as well. So again, those are the all-in-one boxes that don't have a separate SQL server. You can throw those in too. Okay, so that's enough of conferencing. Let's pop back real quick, see if... So let's take a couple look through the client real quick and see a couple things. First bit, meet now. Hidden, really useful, particularly if you want to just spin up a conference, make sure everything's working okay. Note that I have this join meeting audio dialog, really nifty bit for your users, because a lot of times, especially when you're just rolling this out, they may not be comfortable joining audio and video from their laptop. Maybe they don't have a USB headset. Maybe they're just more comfortable with a phone. So you want to make sure they're aware of that capability. And you can actually pick any number that's published in the directory. So in this case, I put my mobile number in. So I was just down in the exhibit hall earlier today, and the Wi-Fi's pretty cruddy down there. So I joined so I could look at the slides, and I just said, call my cell phone. So I can fully participate in the conference, fully authenticated with a single click, and Link just calls me back. I did not understand that. Can you repeat it? No, you do not. And I'll actually cover how you can do that without being enterprise voice enabled in a subsequent slide. Yes. So if I go here, you can move in as an administrator. It's right here under phones. And you can say, even as a user, you can say, don't show me that anymore, or always join all my calls on my mobile, et cetera. So there's various different ways to remove that or enable it. Yes. Here's a bit that we added, this crop and center video in my meetings that disables that smart framing. Like my boss likes to have meetings in his room and he wants to have the big camera with everybody seeing, so you can tick that. We added that in CU1. We also added in CU1 the capability If you're running multiple versions of Link, because you can run Link 2010 and 2013 side by side now. And in this case, I'm also running the Link modern client. So you can decide which of those clients are your default for meetings. All right, so just a couple quick bits in the client. More interestingly, let's go to Outlook. So let's create a meeting. I think I just ticked create link meeting. Yeah, but I could have said just create a new meeting. Nothing's in the body. Let's make it a link meeting. So link's going out to the server, figuring out who I am, what my policies are, and it's populating this body. And in the body, you have the simple URL with my join link. Apparently, it's not so simple because in subsequent releases of the product, we've hidden it and hidden it. Now it's down to just a big blue arrow that says click here. But behind here is that simple URL that we talked about when we built the topology out. It also populates phone numbers by the region that I'm in. It also gives me a link to a dial-in page, which shows all the phone numbers available in my enterprise, lets me manage my PIN. It also has a couple of additional links for help. By default, we create a reservationless meeting. So every single meeting will have the same coordinates. A lot of times that's not ideal. It's easy for users to join, but since it's really easy just to click to join a meeting, that simplicity is not as useful anymore. So you may want to teach your users or as an admin configure every meeting to be a separate meeting, a private meeting. And when you do this, you can actually do some additional configuration options to manage who can get in that meeting. This is actually really important because Link doesn't have the concept of an anonymous meeting. Somebody's got to join as an authenticated user and open it up. So you want to make sure you've enabled folks within your company to be able to join that meeting and open it up for everybody else if they join anonymously. And then there's other bits that you can manage, like who's a presenter and if you want to limit. And go through some of those later. Under the phone option, we group dial-in numbers by region. And so here I can pick a different region. Say I'm inviting a bunch of folks from Paris to participate in my meeting. So here you see the body changes to reflect local dial-in numbers. So important to think about planning these bits of things ahead of time from a dial-in perspective. So given the time, let's pop back and go through some slides that shows what was going on there. So what happens when I click? So we showed that URL gets created. So my client sends a service request to something called the Focus Factory, which actually is in charge of corralling all these MCU resources for your meeting. It checks on the server to see, you know, what policy options you have. It gives you the URL to stick in the body of the meeting. Sends a 200 OK back. All good. We click send. Outlook stores the time of that meeting. Link has no clue the time or recurrence. All Link does is it stores in our RTC database the GUID, effectively, of that meeting. So those are all stored in the meeting as well as the conference IDs. Ooh, I don't think I pointed out the conference ID. In the body of the meeting request, there's a numeric conference ID that when you dial in, you put in that ID to set the meeting that you're joining. So there's an alpha ID that's part of the simple URL, and there's a numeric ID when you call in. So that becomes important in dial-in scenarios. I think we covered that. So apparently, this was one of the most requested features of Link 2013, so I built the whole slide around it. This is all around how you can customize that meeting invite. So basically, we let you customize anything that I showed you in that invitation. We'll let you put a logo on it, you can put a custom disclaimer on it, you can redirect the help URL, you can add a footer, you can add a legal URL. All that stuff's in there on the left-hand side. That's how you see it in the control panel. On the right-hand side is that exact same view in PowerShell. So again, here's the different ways you as an admin can manage your system. This is Get CS Meeting Configuration. By the way, here's an example. You'll see in this PowerShell commandlet, there's one-for-one PowerShell options for what you see in that web page. There's one different one, require room systems authorization. This is actually a new setting we added to 2013 for room systems. So if you want to force authentication every time somebody walks into a Link room and touches the screen to join for privacy, security reasons, this guy will let you as an admin force that. Simple URLs. This is a big planning topic. So as you're looking to rolling out Link, think about this. This maps back to the SIP domains that we created. When I click meet, every single SIP domain is going to have a separate URL that maps to that meet. So meet.contoso.com is the default. If we were to switch back to Topology Builder, that's what it would have added by default, meet.techedna.com, meet.techedema.com. There are certificate and DNS implications for these choices. And you want to make the right choice at the beginning, because if you change this on your users, their meetings will break. And you'll have to manage transferring everybody to a new set of simple URLs. So I've put the three options down on here, from the simplest at the far left to the most complex on the far right. The only reason I'd ever do that one on the far right is if you got a buttload of SIP domains and you really don't want to get into managing a whole bunch of certificates and SAN entries. But it's pretty cumbersome if you see you put a base URI and then a whole bunch of domains off of that. There's a family of CS simple URL commandlets that allow you to manage this. Or you can just do it directly in Topology Builder, go back to Topology Builder, change it how you like, and republish. Those are simple URLs. So what happens when I click one of those simple URLs? How do we crack the URL? How does Link understand what meeting that actually maps to? So I can easily parse out the SIP domain, the organizer. Here's the alphanumeric conference ID. This is not my actual conference ID. If it was, you could just stick this in your browser, click on it, and you would join my reservation list meeting. Right? This is actually an address of an entry in the RTC database of a conference. In this case, my reservation list conference. It can pull out my SIP URI, the organizer URI, and then it converts all this into, this is actually the entity that gets stored in the database. So this is the SIP address of that meeting. You know, puts all that together. So I click join, I look up DNS. Well, what does that point to? It either points to a pool if I'm joining internally, or it's gonna hit a director if I'm coming in through my edge through reverse proxy. There's a little application called the join launcher that then kicks in and applies some logic, because in that initial get request, I'm going to include some information, like if I have the link client, and then it's going to decide, do I launch the link client into that meeting? Do I launch the link web application into that meeting? It's going to send that response back with the right web join, and then if I'm joining from link, it's going to hit that focus entity, which is effectively like a traffic cop for every meeting. Every single meeting, we spin up a focus, and it decides if I need the AVMCU to chime in, or if I need to fail a conference over, if I need to maintain the roster. And all of our new clients, including the web app and all our mobile clients, are going to hit a different interface, which is our new UC web API. So what you guys need to think about is how to optimize that join experience for your users. And it depends on how your users are used to joining meetings. If they're clicking within the rich client or within a mobile client, all good. If they're dialing in, you want to consider some of these things, like making sure if I dial in, I don't sit in the lobby. You want to put them right in the conference. You want to make sure you have somebody anointed as a presenter to open up that meeting. And then you want to think about whether you want the default to be everybody uses the same reservation list ID, or you have a unique ID. I'll give you an example. I used to use that reservation list one because it's easy, right? But then I had one call, the time went over, and it was an internal call, and all of a sudden my second call hit and a bunch of customers started joining, and they could see all the stuff I was presenting. So that's the issue with using that reservation list one. So you might want to consider enabling that assigned conference type. Again, I showed you how a user can override this, and this is how an admin can override it. Okay. Let's pop through this guy real quick. So very important that you enable dial-in. There's still a lot of people with phones out there that are going to want to call into your meetings. Here's how you do this. Upper right, pool one, I've got a new guy, the conferencing attendant. That was installed when I ticked that conferencing dial-in conferencing tick box in Topology Builder. Another guy down here, this pool one is where my dial-in access number's homed. Pool two on the bottom is where my organizer's homed. Right? So that's where the conference is actually going to end up. So when I dial that access number, I hit pool one. I've got on the left side a guy with his Motorola StarTAC dialing into the phone, doesn't have a link client, so he's just dialing that access number. He's putting in his conference ID. And of course, that's going to need to go through a gateway or a SIP trunk and through our mediation server. So how's that look? Inbound call hits mediation. There's a contact object in the directory for that dial-in number. It says, oh, this guy's associated with pool one. Hits that front-end server. Conferencing attendant answers. Well, thanks for calling the conferencing service. What conference do you want? I put in my conference ID, that numeric, in my case, in Microsoft, they're by default like 8 or 9 digits long. Put that in. It does a lookup on these conference directories. That's that number 4 item here. And it figures out the alphanumeric that it corresponds to so that I can figure out which pool is hosting this conference. Once it figures that out, it effectively does a transfer where it moves the call over to the front-end server that's going to host that call. The focus manages that. As I mentioned before, the focus is kind of our logical conference entity. It pulls in the AVMCU. The conference announcement service, either with beeps or by reading names, announces everybody that comes and goes in the meeting. You can turn that on or turn that off. At this point, I've effectively transferred the entire call over to pool 2. And that's that final invite that's sent out with a replace. So signaling bounces all around as we set up the call. But media, which is kind of what you care about from a planning perspective, goes to either that pool 1 for joins. And once the join is done, it's all on pool 2. So I guess the fundamental bit to remember here is a conference is always hosted by the organizer's pool. So all the media and traffic ultimately will go through that pool. Conference IDs. So there's 2. There's the alpha that's in the clickable join link, and there's the numeric that's in that the body of the dial-in page. So when you're joining a call from a phone, you need to put that dial-in in. So short version here is plan ahead and create enough conference directories to keep that number length down. So if you have over 1,000 users, the rule is for every 1,000 users, create another conference directory. And that you can see the algorithm there for that numeric ID, and that'll keep that guy shorter. Because there's nothing that pisses somebody off more that they're trying to dial in from their phone or something, and they got to enter 10 digits, and then they got to enter their PIN. It becomes a tough experience to join from dial-in. So help manage that. So what we'd prefer to do versus dialing in is let link call you, because then we've already authenticated you. Like in that scenario before where I was down in the exhibition hall and I joined the conference from link, but I just said, call me back on my mobile. That's this top scenario here where we just drag somebody into the conference, we call out to them, or we just say, you tell the conferencing server to call you. You can also join with your PBX phone. So if you still have PBX phones out there, you're just deploying conferencing, you don't have EV-enabled users yet, there's no reason they can't either dial in or just have the conferencing service call them back on their PBX extension. And then, of course, the mobile clients, if you have 2010, will call you back. If you have 2013 and you're on Wi-Fi or a well-connected network, we'll just join you directly with IP. So those are really nice, simple, clean join experiences versus the more cumbersome dial-in one. So to the gentleman's question here, this box on the far right, we had a problem in Link 2010 where if you were not EV-enabled, we didn't have a way to route a call so you could join via dial-in. So in 2013, we've given a capability to assign a voice policy to an organizer even if they're not EV-enabled. So you can do it in PowerShell, allow 9 enterprise voice users to dial out. And effectively, it just enables a scenario where you maybe don't have anybody enterprise voice enabled in your company, but there's no reason those folks can't participate in a dial-out or a dial-in conference. Sorry, I'm going a little quicker because I've got about 10 minutes to go. So remember before we could specify a dial-in region, you could change it, and then you also can go to that dial-in page and it'll show you all the conferencing numbers you have. You got to do a little planning on this, and this is how this works. So a dial plan, which is a collection of normalization rules and routes for a particular area, has a region associated with it, one region. That region has one or more access numbers. They can be 800 numbers or local numbers associated with it. Each access number has a display name, hopefully something friendly that tells you the location, when you should use it, because it'll show up on invitations. It also assigns it to a pool. So in that scenario where I did a dial-in, it assigns it to one pool. You can have one language as a primary, but you can have up to 4 secondary languages. So if it's an international, I think we support 16 or 18 different languages, so you can have all those prompts, what's your conference ID, et cetera, in different languages. And here up at the right, which you probably can't read, but if you get the deck, or if you hit your dial-in page, you'll see this renders with all the local dial-in numbers. And remember when I was showing you on my client I could change the region? That correspondingly maps to this. So you want to define clear, understandable regions so your users can populate them and have local access numbers. One little bit here is the set CS dial-in conferencing access number. So if you want to prioritize different numbers, like if you'd rather them call the local number first before the 800 number, you can reorder how those guys sit in with this commandlet, how they display in that list. So we were doing some adoption for a customer, and somebody on my team found this picture. Basically, when you guys deploy this and roll it out, you really want to avoid that scenario where somebody's dialing into a conference, because it really can be painful. And I'll be honest with you, we really don't invest engineering resources into joining from, you know, an old phone that doesn't have the richness with client capabilities. So we really invest in getting that single click rich capabilities you get from the client with all the stuff I've gone through, the cool video and the app sharing. So you really want to try and train your users to get away from this. Here's some techniques. Really quick, you can basically make the conferencing service behave as your current bridge or your current ACP. You can set announcements on or off if that's what your user are used to. You can change the DTMF tones to match them. Some of the things I pointed out before to make sure PSTN users don't get stuck in a lobby waiting for a meeting to start. If you do have a bunch of folks joining with PSTN and they're going to need to authenticate, you have to populate the line URI for all those users, even if they're not EV enabled, because that's how we authenticate them. It's a bit painful, but if you call in and you say, yes, I'm the leader, you put in a PIN and you tell it your phone number, and that's effectively a two-factor authentication. It will actually authenticate you and put you in the meeting as authenticated. If that's a use case that your folks are going to be using, it doesn't work unless that line URI is populated in Active Directory. Finally, these last two, don't have time to go into here, can't emphasize enough. As technical folks, a lot of times we figure it's easy to use. It's not. Changing, especially trained behaviors of using a phone or a bridge that you've done for maybe the past 20 years, it's really hard to unlearn and learn how to just click, put a headset on, and join. So there's a couple reference resources there. We have a whole readiness and adoption kit to help you with that. And we also have a commandlet that will send a welcome email to folks as they're enabled for conferencing. All the links, how to use it, you can customize that, make sure folks adopt the service. Sorry? I'm sorry, I still didn't hear you. No, it's not. It's in 2010 as well. And you can use it as much as you want. So you use it initially when you enable somebody, but if you want to do it again with different types of communication, you can resend that guy as much as you want. All right. Fail to plan, plan to fail. So I don't do enough justice to this topic. I have one slide. I could easily have spent the whole hour talking to you about it. I don't think it would have been as much fun, because this sure was fun. But I don't want you to walk away thinking, just go through Topology Builder, throw out some headsets, stand up a mediation server, and you're good. There's a bit of work to do depending on your requirements and what you're doing. So we have a whole bit on TechNet of how we build the product and the capacity model that we build it against. And that's important if your capacity model doesn't match. So take a look at that. And if it looks like we test the product roughly the same way you do, then you're probably going to be OK with the published numbers that we put in terms of capacity. But make sure you do that due diligence to look at it. We have a whole bunch of resources, a lot of which for 2013 just came out. The bandwidth calculator, I think, just came out the last week or two. The planning tool came out, I think, in February, and the capacity calculator in February, too. But we have all these tools. The planning tools, like, you know, a TurboTax-type tool. What are you going to do? How many users? It draws a pretty picture for you. How are you going to use it? It gives you a sense of what are the right components to deploy. So take a look at all those tools. We also have a stress tool. So if you feel like you're going to be doing a lot of really big meetings or a lot of video, there's no reason you can't stand up a pool in a test environment, beat on it with a stress tool, and make sure it behaves before you order a whole bunch of servers to your specs. So effectively, you want to go through this iterative process. Spend a little time planning, do the modeling, use the tools we've published. If you want to do some capacity planning with our stress tool, go for it. And then do a pilot, see how things are looking, make sure links act and healthy, make sure you have enough capacity. Don't walk away after your pilot. What typically happens with Link is people love it, and the usage starts to skyrocket, and then you get in trouble, and the servers start to tip over. So make sure you have an ongoing view into the capacity of the system. That's that green box. Oh, I'm going to make it. Okay. Whoops. So here's my go-do. We have, I think, the guy who runs all of Microsoft sales. This is his favorite thing. Here's your go-do. He says it in a Texas accent, so I guess it sounds a little bit better. But effectively, here's the sum up here for you guys to be able to walk away with. And if you don't feel like you can do any of this stuff, come find me after. So I've broken it down into five steps. First thing you want to do is do a little bit of planning work. So that last slide, what are your requirements? Do you need regional pools? How many users do you have? How many data centers do you have? What does your network look like? Do you feel like you have the network capacity to take on audio video conferencing? Do you need to supplement that? What supplemental infrastructure are you going to have to worry about? Edge planning, firewalls, load balancers. Link typically will point out all the weak spots in your environment that you weren't aware of, in addition to network, load balancers, DNS certificates, all that stuff. So make sure you do your work on planning. Build's not so tough, right? We went through Topology Builder, but you do need to make some decisions, like how are you going to create simple URLs? What's the naming convention? What WAC model are you going to deploy? Are you going to share that? Are you going to put it in your perimeter network? Make sure you have provision to deploy monitoring. Remember, you're going to need a different SQL server for monitoring. We won't let you put that same database on the front-end pool, but make sure you deploy that monitoring database. So do all that bits on build. Dial-in is a completely separate topic. How are you going to create access numbers? What are the regions? How are you going to map those regions to your dial plan? How are your users going to join? Do you want 800 numbers? What connectivity do you need regionally, whether it's through gateways or through SIP trunking, to make sure you have coverage for all those dial-in access numbers? So there's some bits to just enable all these different services. Go back through. I put all the PowerShell commandlets in there to help you figure out if you need to configure certain things in particular. Conferencing policies allow you to manage which of your users can do which things. All the different conferencing modalities are configurable from within those conferencing policies. So there's a lot of flexibility for you to customize that. And then finally, you get to a run state. And really, this last item is iterative. So once you do all your planning, you get to run. You deploy a site. You deploy a region. You take a look at how it went. Look at your CDR database. See how adoption's going. Do you need to do more work with adoptions? Are users complaining about the join experience with dial-in? Do you need to use that RAS stuff I showed to help drive adoption? How are you doing from a health perspective? Look at the monitoring server. Is call quality where you need it to be? You can see MOS scores right in there. Are your conferences at a high voice quality? Are your users using the right kind of devices? If they're joining over PSTN, are you having problems with that PSTN connection? So take a look at quality, because the worst thing that can happen as you grow is quality drops and people stop using it. It just takes one bad call and your Link service gets a bad name. So look at all that and then do it all over again. And I got a minute left. Sorry, I got a little panicky there when I saw I was only 30 minutes through, and I realized I combined the two sessions. I want to make sure I got through all the content for you guys. So are there? Yeah, there's just the standard bits. So, thank you all. I'll be at Ask the Experts. Happy to take any questions.